Our little series has been entitled, What If? And today's message is entitled, What Good is Riches? The story goes that there was a man who was very wealthy. He had everything a person with means could ever dream of or desire. He had fancy cars. He had a huge mansion for a home. However, he lacked the one thing that he believed would make him happy, grandchildren. His only child, a daughter, had yet to find a suitable mate, and time was ticking by. So the man decided to take things into his own hands. The rich man planned a very lavish party to which he invited all of his executives, particularly many young men who were eligible and single. After the dinner portion of the evening, the rich man invited everyone to come out onto the large deck that surrounded his pool. He then proceeded to make the following announcement. Inside my pool, I have installed several man-eating crocodiles, which we have starved for several weeks. I will give half of my company and my wealth to the one single man who swims across the pool and agrees to marry my daughter. Well, suddenly there was a great splash, and a solitary man feverishly swam across the pool, then pulled himself out just before a croc could grab him. And the rich man rushed over and vigorously shook the young man's hand. That was a very brave thing you did. And true to my word, you're going to have half my wealth and half my company if you agree to marry my daughter. The man, in between gasps for air, said, "Oh, forget your wealth and your daughter. I just want to know who it was who pushed me in." Wealth and the pursuit of wealth occupy so much of our society's thoughts and energy. It seems people are willing to do just about anything to make a few extra bucks. Do you remember the comedian Jack Benny? He used to do a skit where someone posed as a robber or a gunman and pointed a gun at Benny and said, "Your money or your life?" And in the skit, Benny pauses for a fair length of time, and the robber becomes anxious for an answer. And Benny always replied, "Hold on, I'm thinking." Our chapter today, although focusing on the accumulation of things, is really just a part of the overall theme of Ecclesiastes. And the question running through the entire book is simply this: what is your reason for living? Or is there even a reason for living? We've already looked at some ways that people try to find meaning in our journey through Ecclesiastes. But now the writer asks us the question if we believe that greed or the accumulation of wealth might bring us happiness. This is a very timely subject considering the recent U.S. presidential debate in which former President Donald Trump made no apologies for getting all that he could and manipulating the system legally, he claims, to save on taxes. Now, we need to be very clear here. The writer of Ecclesiastes is not against wealth itself. After all, he was a very wealthy man. But rather, he's against the unhealthy approach of searching for happiness through the accumulation of wealth. All along, Ecclesiastes has been stating that true happiness or contentment cannot be found apart from God. In other words, you cannot hug a bank account. Your mutual fund cares not one whit if you are ill. If all that matters to you is money and the accumulation of the same, you will, according to the preacher, live an empty, futile, and spiritually bankrupt life. You see, materialism is not owning things. That's not what it means. Materialism, however, means being owned by things. Therefore, we should not be surprised by all the evil activities that surround the hoarding of money. I've noticed on television shows, particularly in criminal investigations, the police are always asking themselves, or telling themselves, to follow the money. I once heard, and I wish I could remember where I heard it, that almost every dollar bill in the United States has at least a small, minuscule trace of cocaine on it. Take out any $20 bill that you have on your person or nearby, and look at it and ask yourself, well, $20 bill, what have you been used for? Think about how much criminal activity and the exploitation of people is undertaken just to make money. The drug trade, prostitution, pornography, scams over the internet or over the phone. Our governments are not even immune to this, as they readily embrace revenues that are raked in by casinos and gambling. You know, on a related note, have you ever noticed how often when the word greed is used, it's often paired with another word? And that word is envy. So we usually say it as a pair, greed and envy. And what an unholy pair it is. So much of our greedy behavior stems from our envy of other folks. Now we need to understand that envy is not just wanting what someone else has. In actual fact, envy is wanting someone else not to have what they have and for us to own it instead. You think of the story of King Ahab in 1 Kings, and Ahab envied his neighbor Naboth's beautiful vineyard, and he had him killed just to attain it. You see, enviers don't just want things, they want to be envied by others. We envy people and it corrupts our thinking. We think the one who has more of this world or more things is our rival, is to, an enemy to be crushed or somehow diminished. I wonder how many of you know much about the awful history of the Salem witch trials in the early days of the early English Puritan settlements in the United States. If you ever read about them, you will remember that they were an incredibly cruel thing. Many innocent people, mostly women, were burned at the stake or drowned because someone, almost always without proof, accused them of being a witch. Now, historical research has shown that what was really going on, what was the motivation for all this hysteria. Most of the people who were accused of being witches were actually prosperous individuals. They had good land and they had ample resources. Those who made the accusations saw the witch trials as a way to remove the ones who they were envious of, and by default seized their land and their goods. The victims of the trial, who received almost no judicial support at all in terms of a fair trial, were essentially killed so someone could take what they had. In the history of those trials, the poor were never accused. Recently, I read a t-shirt saying, "Lord, let me prove that winning the lottery won't ruin me." Well, the irony is that people who win lotteries often find their lives ruined. Many end up with tragic lives, gambling away their winnings. Some commit suicide. Some have to take out restraining orders on relatives who hound them for money. There have been murders related to lottery winnings. I remember years ago there was a man in Brantford, my hometown, who won a sizable lottery winning. And for several months, he told no one and locked the ticket away in a safety deposit box. But in the meantime, he divorced his wife so he would not have to share the winnings with her. And by the way, in the end, she got half of it anyway. And sadly, a family was destroyed. Jesus was very concerned about what wealth could do to us. In the parable of the sower in Matthew 13, Jesus speaks of how the good seed of the gospel is choked out by the weeds of materialism. The fact is that there are many people in this world who are making a good living, but living poor lives. Life is tragic for someone who has everything but nothing to live for. Again, the problem is not money, but rather it is the love of money. It has, since our creation, been God's intention that we find our purpose, our security, and our delight in Him. Yet on any given Sunday, until the pandemic came, of course, which church had the best attendance in our area? It's the mall, or Costco, the cathedrals of consumerism. Even when warned to stay home in the pandemic, people still flock to the big box stores to spend their money. I made an observation recently about those cheesy TV ads that sell you things that you can only order by phone. The ones that always end with the line at the end, "Oh, but wait. Order now and we'll double your order. Only pay for separate shipping and handling." The products are often depicted as being quite ingenious. They seem to be very helpful. And I find myself thinking, gee, I never knew I needed a device that so that I could just clap my hands and the lights would go out. Or a hose that when the water drains out, it shrinks down to pocket size. Boy, I've always wanted a hose that I could carry in my pocket. How do we ever live without such things, we tell ourselves? However, I've noticed in my home, maybe in yours too, we have lots of gadgets and thingamajigs that we thought would be helpful, but we never use them. They just sit around and gather dust. Having things also leads to real anxiety in us. The more you have, the more you're afraid that you will lose. We are afraid our stock portfolios will take a hit, or someone will break into our homes and steal our stuff. So we have alarm systems, we have deadbolts, we have electronic tracers and microchips embedded in all kinds of things, all in an effort to try and recover what was lost. My one cousin told me a few years back that he has an app on his phone. And this app randomly and frequently generates new passwords for his bank accounts, lest someone somehow get in and get his information and clean them out. People are so afraid of losing things that they've taken to securing them in boxes in a bank called safety deposit boxes. Recently in England, thieves broke into a bank and robbed the safety boxes there and made away with about $7 million in cash and merchandise. One woman was interviewed and she lost, she said, $500,000 in jewelry. And reacting to the news of the robbery, she said, "Everything I had was in there. My whole life was in that box." How sad is that? Her whole life was in a small metal box inside a bank vault. The stress of accumulating has led to a new issue in our lives where we need constant escape from that pressure. We now talk about the need to get away from it all, away from the prisons that we have created with our wealth and our envy. So I ask you, how much of what you hold dear is actually meaningless, like chasing the wind? In the late 1800s, an American tourist was visiting Poland and was invited to the home of renowned Rabbi Hafetz Chaim. The tourist was surprised that when he came to the rabbi's home, it was very Spartan. Just a few books, a table, and a simple bench was all he could see. And the tourist remarked, "Rabbi, where is your furniture?" And the rabbi replied, "Well, where's yours?" "Mine," the tourist reacted, "but I'm a visitor here. I'm just passing through." "So am I," said the rabbi. "So we all are." Now I know what you're likely wondering. That covers verses 8 to 20, but what about verses 1 to 7? Well, at first I saw these two sections as separate topics, but as I pondered it, I couldn't help but see that they are connected. The writer encourages his readers in the first part of this chapter to be very careful when they are in the house of God. He commends us not to make foolish promises to God, and if we do make a promise to God, we should follow through and honor that promise quickly. It is also not excusable to make a promise to God and then come to the temple messenger or the minister or church leader and claim that you made a mistake and you want to take it back. It's better, he says, to say nothing. These words are clearly instruction on attitude in worship. We are commended in John's Gospel, chapter 4, to worship God in spirit and in truth. The two sections of Ecclesiastes chapter 5 are connected because what do people like to say to God when they are in the church pew? They desire wealth. gee, God, if you only let me win the lottery, I'll give some to the poor. Gee, Lord, if you only give me that job promotion, I'll go to church every week. How foolish are promises that we make that are really based on envy and greed? How ridiculous it sounds to be asking God for stuff we don't really need. Years ago, Janis Joplin wrote a famous song that when I was in university, my friends liked to quote all the time, but I've never really actually looked at the full set of lyrics before. And they're quite telling in their bluntness, and that was Joplin's point. Entitled Mercedes-Benz, the words go like this. Oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? My friends all drive Porsches, I must make amends. Worked hard all my life, no help from my friends. So Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? Oh Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Dialing for dollars is trying to call me. I wait for delivery each day until 3. Oh, so oh Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Oh Lord, won't you buy me a night on the town? I'm counting on you, Lord. Please don't let me down. Prove that you love me and buy the next round. Oh Lord, give me a night on the town. Oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime, no help from my friends. So oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? It was released in 1970, this song, but it could be the anthem for our time as well. And I should point out the reference to Dialing for Dollars is about a show that used to be on TV, which I remember when I was a kid, in which the host would call people randomly, and if they answered a question, they would win money. Joplin was seeking to critique the materialism of her age. Her point is that it makes a mockery of our faith and of God by seeing God as kind of a cosmic dispensing machine. Chuck Swindoll states the situation very accurately when he wrote, "We'll miss contentment if keeping rather than releasing becomes our objective. We too often love things and use people when we should be using things and loving people. We are most content when we are grateful for what we own, satisfied with what we make, and generous to those in need." So what good are riches if it leads to emptiness and heartache? It is far better, is it not, to store up treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroy.